Chapter 17. Wendy Takes a Fall. 1. The situation would have resolved itself in some way or other, no matter what happened. Thad was sure of that. George Stark wasn't simply going to go away. But Thad came to feel, and not without justification, that Wendy's tumble from the stairs 2 days after Stark called him at Dave's Market set just what course the situation would take for good and all. The most important result was that it finally showed him a course of action. He had spent those 2 days in a sort of breathless lull. He found it difficult to follow even the most simple-minded TV program, impossible to read, and the idea of writing seemed roughly akin to the idea of faster-than-light travel. Mostly he wandered from one room to the next, sitting for a few moments and then moving on again. He got under Liz's feet and on her nerves. She wasn't sharp with him about it, although he guessed she had to bite her tongue on more than one occasion to keep from giving him the verbal equivalent of a paper cut. Twice he set out to tell her about the second call from Stark, the one where Foxy George had told him exactly what was on his mind, secure in the knowledge that the line wasn't tapped and they were speaking privately. On both occasions he had stopped, aware that he could do nothing but upset her more. And twice he had found himself up in his study, actually holding one of those damned barrel pencils he had promised never to use again, and looking at a fresh cellophane-wrapped pile of the notebooks Stark had used to write his novels. "You got an idea, the one about the wedding and the armored car score." And that was true. Thad even had a title, a good one, Steel Machine. Something else was true, too. Part of him really wanted to write it. That itch was there, like that one place on your back you can't quite reach when you need to scratch. George would scratch it for you. Oh, yes. George would be happy to scratch it for him. But something would happen to him, because things had changed now, hadn't they? What exactly would that thing be? He didn't know, perhaps couldn't know, but a frightening image kept recurring to him. It was from that charming, racist children's tale of yore, Little Black Sambo. When Black Sambo climbed the tree and the tigers couldn't get him, they became so angry that they bit each other's tails and raced faster and faster around the tree until they turned into butter. Sambo gathered the butter up in a crock and took it home to his mother. George the Alchemist, Thad had mused, sitting in his study and tapping an unsharpened barrel black beauty against the edge of the desk. Straw into gold, tigers into butter, books into bestsellers, and Thad into... what? He didn't know. He was afraid to know. But he would be gone. Thad would be gone. He was sure of that. There might be somebody living here who looked like him, but behind that Thad Beaumont face there would be another mind. A sick, brilliant mind. He thought the new Thad Beaumont would be a good deal less clumsy, and a good deal more dangerous. Liz and the babies? Would Stark leave them alone if he did make it into the driver's seat? Not him. He had considered running as well, packing Liz and the twins into the Suburban and just going. But what good would that do? What good, when foxy old George could look out through dumb old Thad's eyes? It wouldn't matter if they ran to the end of the earth. They would get there, look around, and see George Stark mushing after them behind a team of huskies, his straight razor in his hand. He considered, and even more rapidly and decisively, dismissed the idea of calling Alan Pangborn. Alan had told them where Dr. Pritchard was, and his decision not to try to get a message through to the neurosurgeon, to wait until Pritchard and his wife returned from their camping trip, told Thad all he needed to know about what Alan believed, and, more important, what he did not believe. If he told Alan about the call he'd received in Dave's, Alan would think he was making it up. Even if Rosalie confirmed the fact that he had received a call from someone at the market, Alan would go on not believing. He and all the other police officers who had invited themselves to this particular party had a big investment in not believing. So the days passed slowly, and they were a kind of white time. Just after noon on the second day, Thad jotted, "I feel as if I'm in a mental version of the horse latitudes," in his journal. It was the only entry he had made in a week, and he began to wonder if he would ever make another one. His new novel, The Golden Dog, was sitting dead in the water. That, he supposed, went almost without saying. It was very hard to make up stories when you were afraid a bad man, a very bad man, was going to show up and slaughter your whole family before starting in on you. The only time he could recall being at such a loss with himself had been in the weeks after he had quit drinking. After he'd pulled the plug on the booze bath he'd wallowed in following Liz's miscarriage and before Stark appeared. Then, as now, there had been the feeling that there was a problem, but it was as unapproachable as one of those water mirages you see at the end of a flat stretch of highway on a hot afternoon. The harder he ran toward the problem, wanting to attack it with both hands, dismantle it, destroy it, the faster it receded, until he was finally left, panting and breathless, with that bogus ripple of water still mocking him at the horizon. These nights he slept badly, and dreamed George Stark was showing him his own deserted house. A house where things exploded when he touched them, and where, in the last room, the corpses of his wife and Frederick Clausen were waiting. But the moment he got there, all the birds would begin to fly, exploding upward from trees and telephone lines and electricity poles. Thousands of them, millions of them. So many that they blotted out the sun. Until Wendy fell on the stairs, he felt very much like fools stuffing himself. Just waiting for the right murderous somebody to come along, tuck a napkin into his collar, pick up his fork, and begin to eat. 2. The twins had been crawling for some time, and for the last month or so they had been pulling themselves up to a standing position with the aid of the nearest stable, or in some cases unstable, object. A chair leg was good, as was the coffee table, but even an empty cardboard carton would serve, at least until the twin in question put too much weight on it and it crumpled inward or turned turtle. Babies are capable of getting themselves into divine messes at any age, but at the age of 8 months, when crawling has served its purpose and walking has not quite been learned, they are clearly in the golden age of mess-making. Liz had set them out on the floor to play in a bright patch of sun around 4:45 in the afternoon. After 10 minutes or so of confident crawling and shaky standing, the latter accompanied by lusty crows of accomplishment to their parents and to each other, William pulled himself up on the edge of the coffee table. He glanced around and made several imperious gestures with his right arm. These gestures reminded Thad of old news films showing Il Duce addressing his constituency from his balcony. Then William seized his mother's teacup and managed to pour the lees all over himself before toppling backward onto his bottom. The tea was fortunately cold, but William held onto the cup and managed to wrap it against his mouth smartly enough to make his lower lip bleed a little. He began to wail. Wendy promptly joined in. Liz picked him up, examined him, rolled her eyes at Thad, and took him upstairs to soothe him and then clean him up. "Keep an eye on the princess," she said as she went. "I will," Thad said. But he had discovered, and would shortly rediscover, that in the golden age of mess-making, such promises often amount to little. William had managed to snatch Liz's teacup from under her very nose, and Thad saw that Wendy was going to fall from the third stair riser just a moment too late to save her the tumble. He had been looking at a news magazine, not reading it but thumbing idly through it, glancing every now and then at a picture. When he was finished, he went over to the large knitting basket by the fireplace, which served as a sloppy sort of magazine rack, to put it back and get another. Wendy was crawling across the floor, her tears forgotten before they were entirely dry on her chubby cheeks. She was making the breathy little room, room, room sound both of them uttered when crawling, a sound that sometimes made Thad wonder if they associated all movement with the cars and trucks they saw on TV. He squatted, put the magazine on top of the pile in the basket, and thumbed through the others, finally selecting a month-old Harper's for no particular reason. It occurred to him that he was behaving quite a bit like a man in a dentist's office waiting for a tooth extraction. He turned around, and Wendy was on the stairs. She had crawled up to the third one and was now rising shakily to her feet, holding onto one of the spindles which ran between the rail of the banister and the floor. As he looked at her, she spied him and gave a particularly grandiloquent arm gesture and a grin. The sweep of her arm sent her chubby body swaying forward over the short drop. "Jesus," he said under his breath. And as he rose to his feet, knees popping dryly, he saw her take a step forward and let go of the spindle. "Wendy, don't do that!" He nearly leaped across the room and almost made it. But he was a clumsy man, and one of his feet caught on the leg of the armchair. It fell over, and Thad went sprawling. Wendy fell outward and forward with a startled little squawk. Her body turned slightly in midair. He grabbed for her from his knees, trying to make a saving catch, and missed by a good 2 feet. Her right leg struck the first stair riser, and her head struck the carpeted floor of the living room with a muffled thud. She screamed, and he had time to think how terrifying a baby's cry of pain is, and then he had swept her into his arms. Overhead, Liz called out, "Thad?" in a startled voice, and he heard the thump-thump of her slippered feet running down the hall. Wendy was trying to cry. Her first yell of pain had expelled all but the tidal air from her lungs, and now came the paralyzing, eternal moment when she struggled to unlock her chest and draw in breath for the next whoop. It would bludgeon the eardrums when it finally came. If it came. He held her, looking anxiously into her twisted, blood-engorged face. It had gone a color which was almost puce, except for the red mark like a very large comma on her forehead. God, what if she passes out? What if she strangles to death, unable to pull in breath and utter the cry locked in her flat little lungs? "Cry, damn it!" he shouted down at her. God, her purple face, her bulging, stricken eyes. "Cry!" "Thad!" Liz sounded very scared now, but she also seemed very distant. In those few eternal seconds between Wendy's first cry and her struggle to free the second one and go on breathing, George Stark was driven totally out of Thad's mind for the first time in the last 8 days. Wendy drew in a great convulsive breath and began to whoop. Thad, trembling with relief, hugged her to his shoulder and began to stroke her back gently, making shushing sounds. Liz came pounding downstairs, a struggling William clasped against her side like a small bag of grain.
"What happened? Thad, is she all right?"
"Yes, she took a tumble from the third stair up. She's fine now. Once she started crying, at first it was like she just locked up." He laughed shakily and traded Wendy for William, who was now bellowing in sympathetic harmony with his sister.
"Weren't you watching her?" Liz asked reproachfully.
She was automatically swinging her body back and forth at the hips, rocking Wendy, trying to soothe her.
"Yes? No. I went over to get a magazine. Next thing I knew, she was on the stairs. It was like Will in the teacup. They're just so damned eely.
Is her head all right, do you think? She hit it on the carpet, but she hit hard." Liz held Wendy at arm's length for a moment, looked at the red mark, then kissed it gently. Wendy's sobs were already beginning to diminish in volume.
"I think it's okay. She'll have a bump for a day or two, that's all. Thank God for the carpet. I didn't mean to jump on you, Thad. I know how quick they are. I feel like I'm going to have my period, only it's all the time now."
Wendy's sobs were winding down to sniffles. Accordingly, William also began to dry up. He reached out a chubby arm and snatched at his sister's white cotton T-shirt. She looked around. He cooed, then babbled at her. To Thad, their babbling always sounded a little eerie, like a foreign language which had been speeded up just enough so you couldn't quite tell which one it was, let alone understand it. Wendy smiled at her brother, although her eyes were still streaming tears and her cheeks were wet with them. She cooed and babbled in reply. For a moment, it was as if they were holding a conversation in their own private world, the world of twins. Wendy reached out and caressed William's shoulder. They looked at each other and went on cooing.
"Are you all right, sweet one?"
"Yes, I hurt myself, dear William, but not badly."
"Will you want to stay home from the Stadleys' dinner party, dear heart?"
"I should think not, although you are very thoughtful to ask."
"Are you quite sure, my dear Wendy?"
"Yes, darling William. No damage has been done, although I greatly fear I have shit in my diapers."
"Oh, sweetheart, how tiresome."
Thad smiled a little, then looked at Wendy's leg. "That's going to bruise," he said. "In fact, it looks like it's started already." Liz offered him a little smile.
"It will heal," she said. "And it won't be the last."
Thad leaned forward and kissed the tip of Wendy's nose, thinking how fast and how furiously these storms blew in. Not 3 minutes ago, he had been afraid she might die from lack of oxygen. And how fast they blew back out again.
"No," he agreed. "God willing, it won't be the last."
3. By the time the twins got up from their late naps at 7 that evening, the bruise on Wendy's upper thigh had turned a dark purple. It had an odd and distinctive mushroom shape.
"Thad,"
Liz said from the other changing table, "look at this." Thad had removed Wendy's nap diaper, slightly dewy but not really wet, and dropped it into the diaper bucket marked hers. He carried his naked daughter over to his son's changing table to see what Liz wanted him to see. He looked down at William, and his eyes widened.
"What do you think?"
she asked quietly.
"Is that weird or what?"
Thad looked down at William for a long time. "Yeah," he said at last. "That's pretty weird." She was holding her wriggling son on the changing table with a hand on his chest. Now she looked sharply around at Thad.
"Are you okay?"
"Yes," Thad said. He was surprised at how calm he sounded to himself. A large white light seemed to have gone off, not in front of his eyes like a flash gun, but behind them. Suddenly, he thought he understood about the birds, a little, and what the next step should be. Just looking down at his son and seeing the bruise on his leg, identical in shape, color, and location to the one on Wendy's leg, had made him understand that. When Will had grabbed Liz's teacup and upended it all over himself, he had sat down hard on his butt. So far as Thad knew, William hadn't done anything to his leg at all. Yet there it was, a sympathetic bruise on the upper thigh of his right leg, a bruise which was almost mushroom-shaped.
"You sure you're okay?" Liz persisted.
"They share their bruises, too," he said, looking down at William's leg.
"Thad?"
"I'm fine," he said, and brushed her cheek with his lips. "Let's get psycho and somatic dressed. What do you say?" Liz burst out laughing.
"Thad, you're crazy," she said.
He smiled at her. It was a slightly peculiar, slightly distant smile.
"Yeah," he said. "Crazy like a fox."
He took Wendy back to her changing table and began to diaper her. Part 2. Stark takes charge. "Any fool with fast hands can take a tiger by the balls," Machine told Jack Halstead. "Did you know that?" Jack began to laugh. The look Machine turned on him made him think better of it. "Wipe that asshole grin off your face and pay attention to me," Machine said. "I am giving you instruction here. Are you paying attention?"
"Yes, Mr. Machine."
"Then hear this and never forget it. Any fool with fast hands can take a tiger by the balls, but it takes a hero to keep on squeezing. I'll tell you something else while I'm at it. Only heroes and quitters walk away, Jack. No one else. And I am no quitter." Machine's Way by George Stark. Chapter 15. Stark Disbelief. 1. Thad and Liz sat encased in shock so deep and blue it felt like ice, listening as Alan Pangborn told them how the early morning hours had gone in New York City. Mike Donaldson, slashed and beaten to death in the hallway of his apartment building. Phyllis Myers and two policemen gunned down at her West Side condo. The night doorman at Myers's building had been hit with something heavy and had suffered a fractured skull. The doctors held out odds slightly better than even that he would wake up on the mortal side of heaven. The doorman at Donaldson's building was dead. The wet work had been carried out gangland style in all cases, with the hitter simply walking up to his victims and starting in. As Alan talked, he referred to the killer repeatedly as Stark. "He's calling him by his right name without even thinking about it," Thad mused. Then he shook his head, a little impatient with himself. You had to call him something, he supposed, and Stark was maybe a little better than the Perp or Mr. X. It would be a mistake at this point to think Pangborn was using the name in any way other than as a convenient handle. What about Rick? He asked when Alan had finished and he was finally able to unlock his tongue. Mr. Cowley is alive and well and under police protection. It was 10:15 in the morning. The explosion, which would kill Rick and one of his guardians, was still almost 2 hours away. Phyllis Myers was under police protection, too, Liz said. In the big playpen, Wendy was fast asleep and William was nodding out.
His head would go down on his chest, his eyes would close, then he would jerk his head up again. To Alan, he looked comically like a sentry trying not to fall asleep on duty. But each head jerk was a little weaker. Watching the twins, his notebook now closed and in his lap, Alan noticed an interesting thing. Every time William jerked his head up in an effort to stay awake, Wendy twitched in her sleep. Have the parents noticed that? He wondered, and then thought, of course they have. That's true, Liz. He surprised them. Police are as prone to surprise as anyone else, you know. They're just supposed to react to it better. On the floor where Phyllis Myers lived, several people along the hall opened their doors and looked out after the shots were fired. And we've got a pretty good idea of what went down from their statements and what the police found at the crime scene. Stark pretended to be a blind man. He hadn't changed his clothes following the murders of Miriam Cowley and Michael Donaldson, which were, forgive me, both of you, but they were messy. He comes out of the elevator wearing dark glasses he probably bought in Times Square or from a pushcart vendor, and waving a white cane covered with blood. God knows where he got the cane, but NYPD thinks he also used it to bash the doorman. He stole it from a real blind man, of course, Thad said calmly. This guy is not Sir Galahad, Alan. Obviously not. He was probably yelling that he'd been mugged, or maybe that he had been attacked by burglars in his apartment. Either way, he came onto them so fast they didn't have much time to react. They were, after all, a couple of prowl car cops who were hauled off their beat and stuck in front of this woman's door without much warning. But surely they knew that Donaldson had been murdered too, Liz protested. If something like that couldn't alert them to the fact the man was dangerous. They also knew Donaldson's police protection had arrived after the man had been murdered, Thad said. They were overconfident. Maybe they were, a little, Alan conceded. I have no way of knowing. But the guys with Cowley know that this man is daring and quite clever as well as homicidal. Their eyes are open. No, Thad, your agent is safe. You can count on it. You said there were witnesses, Thad said. Oh, yeah, lots of witnesses. At the Cowley woman's place, at Donaldson's, at Myers's. He didn't seem to give a shit. He looked at Liz and said, excuse me. She smiled briefly. I've heard that one a time or two before, Alan. He nodded, gave her a little smile, and turned back to Thad. The description I gave you? It checks out all down the line, Alan said. He's big, blonde, got a pretty good tan. So, tell me who he is, Thad. Give me a name. I've got a lot more than Homer Gamache to worry about now. I've got the goddamn police commissioner of New York City leaning on me. Sheila Brigham, that's my chief dispatcher, thinks I'm going to be a media star, but it's still Homer I care about. Even more than the two dead police officers who were trying to protect Phyllis Myers, I care about Homer. So give me a name. I already have, Thad said. There was a long silence, perhaps 10 seconds. Then, very softly, Alan said, what? His name is George Stark. Thad was surprised to hear how calm he sounded, even more surprised to find that he felt calm. Unless deep shock and calm felt the same. But the relief of actually saying that, you have his name is George Stark, was inexpressible. I don't think I understand you, Alan said after another long pause. Of course you do, Alan, Liz said. Thad looked at her, startled by the crisp, no-nonsense tone of her voice. What my husband is saying is that his pseudonym has somehow come to life. The tombstone in the picture, what it says on that tombstone where there should be a homily or a little verse, is something Thad said to the wire service reporter who originally broke the story. Not a very nice guy. Do you recall that?
Yes, but Liz...
He was looking at them both with a kind of helpless surprise, as if realizing for the first time that he had been holding a conversation with people who had lost their minds. Save your butts, she said in the same brisk tone. You'll have plenty of time for buts and rebuttals, you and everyone else. For the time being, just listen to me. Thad wasn't kidding when he said George Stark wasn't a very nice guy. He may have thought he was kidding, but he wasn't. I knew it, even if he didn't. Not only was George Stark not a very nice guy, he was in fact a horrible guy. He made me more nervous with each of the 4 books he wrote. And when Thad finally decided to kill him, I went upstairs to our bedroom and cried with relief. She looked at Thad, who was staring at her. She measured him with her gaze before nodding.
That's right. I cried. I really cried.
Mr. Clausen in Washington was a disgusting little creepazoid, but he did us a favor. Maybe the biggest favor of our married life together. And for that reason, I'm sorry he's dead, if for no other.
Liz, I don't think you really mean... Don't tell me what I do and do not mean, she said.
Alan blinked. Her voice remained modulated, not loud enough to waken Wendy or cause William to do more than raise his head one final time before lying down on his side and falling asleep beside his sister. Alan had a feeling that, if not for the kids, he would have heard a louder voice, though. Maybe even one turned up to full volume.
Thad has got some things to tell you now. You need to listen to him very carefully, Alan, and you need to try and believe him, because if you don't, I'm afraid this man, or whatever he is, will go on killing until he's worked all the way to the bottom of his butcher's bill. I have some very personal reasons for not wanting that to happen. You see, I think Thad and I and our babies may well be on that list.
All right. His own voice was mild, but his thoughts were clicking over at a rapid rate. He made a conscious effort to push frustration, anger, even wonder aside and consider this mad idea as clearly as he could. Not the question of whether it was true or false, it was, of course, impossible even to consider it as true, but the one of just why they were even bothering to tell such a story in the first place. Was it concocted to hide some imagined complicity in the murders? A real one? Was it even possible that they believed it? It seemed impossible that such a pair of well-educated and rational, up to now anyway, people, could believe it. But it was as it had been on the day he had come to arrest Thad for Homer's murder. They just didn't give off the faint but unmistakable aroma of people who were lying. Consciously lying, he amended to himself. Go on, Thad.
All right, Thad said.
He cleared his throat nervously and got up. His hand went to his breast pocket, and he realized with an amusement that was half bitter what he was doing, reaching for the cigarettes which had not been there for years now. He stuffed his hands into his pockets and looked at Alan Pangborn as he might look at a troubled advisee who had washed up on the mostly friendly shores of Thad's office.
Something very odd is going on here. No, it's more than odd. It's terrible and it's inexplicable, but it is happening. And it started, I think, when I was just 11 years old.
2. Thad told it all. The childhood headaches, the shrill cries and muddy visions of the sparrows which had heralded the arrival of these headaches, the return of the sparrows. He showed Alan the manuscript page with "The Sparrows Are Flying" slashed across it in dark pencil strokes. He told him about the fugue state he had entered at his office yesterday, and what he had written, as well as he could remember it, on the back of the order form. He explained what had happened to the form and tried to express the fear and bewilderment which had compelled him to destroy it. Alan's face remained impassive. "Besides," Thad finished, "I know it's Stark. Here." He made a fist and knocked lightly on his own chest. Alan said nothing at all for a few moments. He had begun turning his wedding ring on the third finger of his left hand, and this operation seemed to have captured all his attention.
"You've lost weight since you were married," Liz said quietly. "If you don't have that ring sized, Alan, you'll lose it one day."
"I suppose I will." He raised his head and looked at her. When he spoke, it was as if Thad had left the room on some errand and only the two of them were there. "Your husband took you upstairs to his study and showed you this first message from the spirit world after I left. Is that correct?"
"The only spirit world I know about for sure is the agency liquor store about a mile down the road," Liz said evenly. "But he did show me the message after you left, yes."
"Right after I left?"
"No, we put the twins to bed, and then, while we were getting ready for bed ourselves, I asked Thad what he was hiding."
"Between the time when I left and the time when he told you about the blackouts and the bird sounds, there were periods when he was out of your sight? Times when he could have gone upstairs and written the phrase I mentioned to you?"
"I don't remember for sure," she said. "I think we were together all that time, but I can't say absolutely. And it wouldn't matter even if I told you he never left my sight, would it?"
"What do you mean, Liz?"
"I mean, you'd then assume I was also lying, wouldn't you?"
Alan sighed deeply. It was the only answer either of them really needed.
Thad isn't lying about this.
Alan nodded his head.
I appreciate your honesty, but since you can't swear he never left you for a couple of minutes, I don't have to accuse you of lying. I'm glad of that. You admit the opportunity may have been there, and I think you'll also admit that the alternative is pretty wild.
Thad leaned against the mantel, his eyes shifting back and forth like the eyes of a man watching a tennis match. Sheriff Pangborn was not saying a thing Thad had not foreseen, and he was pointing out the holes in his story a good deal more kindly than he might have done, but Thad found that he was still bitterly disappointed, almost heartsick. That premonition that Alan would believe, somehow just instinctively believe, had proved as bogus as a bottle of medicine show cure-all.
"Yes, I admit those things," Liz said evenly.
"As for what Thad claims happened at his office, there are no witnesses to either the blackout or to what he claims to have written down. In fact, he didn't mention the incident to you at all until after Ms. Cowley called, did he?"
"No, he did not."
"And so?" He shrugged.
"I have a question for you, Alan."
"All right."
"Why would Thad lie? What purpose would it serve?"
"I don't know."
Alan looked at her with complete candor. "He may not know himself." He glanced briefly at Thad, then returned his eyes to Liz's.
"He may not even know he is lying. What I'm saying is pretty flat. This is not the sort of thing any police officer could accept without strong proof, and there is none."
"Thad is telling the truth about this."
"I understand everything you've said, but I want very badly for you to believe he is telling the truth, too. I want that desperately. You see, I lived with George Stark, and I know how Thad was about him as time went on. I'll tell you something that wasn't in People magazine. Thad started talking about getting rid of Stark 2 books before the last one."
"3, Thad said quietly from his place by the mantel. His craving for a cigarette had become a dry fever.
"I started talking about it after the first one."
"Okay, 3.
The magazine article made it sound as though this was a pretty recent thing, and that just wasn't true. That's the point I'm trying to make. If Frederick Clausen hadn't come along and forced my husband's hand, I think Thad would still be talking about getting rid of him in the same way, the way an alcoholic or drug addict tells his family and his friends that he'll quit tomorrow, or the next day, or the day after that."
"No," Thad said, "not exactly like that. Right church, but the wrong pew."
He paused, frowning, doing more than thinking. Concentrating. Alan reluctantly gave up the idea that they were lying or having him on for some weird reason. They were not spending their efforts in order to convince him or even themselves, but only to articulate how it had been, the way men might try to describe a firefight long after it was over.
"Look," Thad said finally, "let's drop the subject of the blackouts and the sparrows and the precognitive visions, if that's what they were, for a minute. If you feel you need to, you can talk to my doctor, George Hume, about the physical symptoms. Maybe the head tests I took yesterday will show something odd when they come back, and even if they don't, the doctor who performed the operation on me when I was a kid may still be alive and able to talk to you about the case. He may know something that could cast some light on this mess. I can't remember his name right offhand, but I'm sure it's in my medical records. But right now, all of this psychic shit is a sidetrack."
This struck Alan as a very odd thing for Thad to say. If he had planted the one precognitive note and lied about the other, someone crazy enough to do such a thing, and crazy enough to forget he'd done it, to actually believe the notes were real manifestations of psychic phenomena, would want to talk about nothing else, wouldn't he? His head was beginning to ache.
"All right," he said evenly. "If what you call this psychic shit is a sidetrack, then what's the main line?"
"George Stark is the main line," Thad said, and thought, "the line that goes to Ennsville, where all rail service terminates."
"Imagine that some stranger moved into your house, someone you've always been a little bit frightened of, the way Jim Hawkins was always a little bit frightened of the old sea dog at the Admiral Benbow. Have you read Treasure Island, Alan?"
He nodded.
"Well, you know the sort of feeling I'm trying to express, then. You're scared of this guy, and you don't like him at all, but you let him stay. You don't run an inn, like in Treasure Island, but maybe you think he's a distant relative of your wife's or something. Do you follow me?"
Alan nodded. And finally, one day, after this bad guest has done something like slam the salt cellar against the wall because it's clogged, you say to your wife, "How long is your idiot second cousin going to hang around anyway?" And she looks at you and says, "My second cousin? I thought he was your second cousin." Alan grunted laughter in spite of himself. "But do you kick the guy out?" Thad went on. "No. For one thing, he's already been in your house for a while, and as grotesque as it might sound to someone who's not actually in the situation, it seems like he's got squatter's rights or something. But that isn't the important thing." Liz had been nodding. Her eyes had the excited, grateful look of a woman who has just been told the word which has been dancing on the tip of her tongue all day long. "The important thing is how goddamned scared of him you are," she said. "Scared of what he might do if you actually told him flat out to take his act and put it on the road." "There you go," Thad said. "You want to be brave and tell him to leave, and not just because you're afraid he might be dangerous either. It becomes a matter of self-respect. But you keep putting it off. You find reasons to put it off. Like it's raining out, and he's less apt to raise the roof about going if you show him the door on a sunny day. Or maybe after you've all had a good night's sleep. You think of 1,000 reasons to put it off. You find that if the reasons sound good enough to yourself, you can retain at least some of your self-respect, and some is better than none at all. Some is also better than all of it, if having all of it means you wind up hurt or dead. And maybe not just you." Liz chimed in again, speaking with the composed and pleasant voice of a woman addressing a gardening club, perhaps on the subject of when to plant corn or how to tell when your tomatoes will be ready for harvesting. "He was an ugly, dangerous man when he was living with us, and he is an ugly, dangerous man now. The evidence suggests that if anything has happened, he's gotten much worse. He's insane, of course, but by his own lights, what he's doing is a perfectly reasonable thing, tracking down the people who conspired to kill him and wiping them out, one after another." "Are you done?" She looked at Alan, startled, as if his voice had brought her out of a deep private reverie. "What?" "I asked if you were done. You wanted to have your say, and I want to make sure you got it." Her calm broke. She fetched a deep sigh and ran her hands distractedly through her hair. "You don't believe it, do you? Not a single word of it." "Liz," Alan said, "this is just nuts. I'm sorry to use a word like that, but considering the circumstances, I'd say it's the kindest one available. There will be other cops here soon enough. FBI, I imagine. This man can now be considered an interstate fugitive, and that'll bring them into it. If you tell them this story, complete with the blackouts and the ghostwriting, you'll hear plenty less kind ones. If you told me these people had been murdered by a ghost, I wouldn't believe you either." Thad stirred, but Alan held a hand up and he subsided, at least for the moment. "But I could have come closer to believing a ghost story than this. We're not just talking about a ghost. We're talking about a man who never was." "How do you explain my description?" Thad asked suddenly. "What I gave you was my private picture of what George Stark looks like. Some of it is in the author profile sheet Darwin Press has in its files. Some was just stuff I had in my head. I never sat down and deliberately visualized the guy, you know. I just formed a kind of mental picture over a period of years, the way you form a mental picture of the disc jockey you listen to every morning on your way to work. But if you ever happened to meet the disc jockey, it turns out you had it all wrong in most cases. It appears I had it mostly right. How do you explain that?" "I can't," Alan said, "unless, of course, you're lying about where the description came from." "You know I'm not." "Don't assume that," Alan said. He rose, walked over to the fireplace, and jabbed restlessly with the poker at the birch logs piled there. "Not every lie springs from a conscious decision. If a man has persuaded himself he's telling the truth, he can even pass a lie detector test with flying colors. Ted Bundy did it." "Come on," Thad snapped. "Stop straining so goddamn hard. This is like the fingerprint business all over again. The only difference is that this time I can't just trot out a bunch of corroboration. What about the fingerprints, by the way? When you add that in, doesn't it at least suggest that we're telling the truth?" Alan turned around. He was suddenly angry at Thad, at both of them. He felt as if he were being relentlessly driven into a corner, and they had no goddamn right to make him feel that way. It was like being the only person at a meeting of the Flat Earth Society who believes the Earth is round.
I can't explain any of that stuff, yet, he said. But in the meantime, maybe you'd like to tell me exactly where this guy, the real one, came from,
Thad. Did you just sort of give birth to him one night? Did he pop out of a damn sparrow's egg? Did you look like him while you were writing the books that eventually appeared under his name? Exactly how did it go?
I don't know how he came to be, Thad said wearily. Don't you think I'd tell you if I could? So far as I know or can remember, I was me when I wrote Machine's Way and Oxford Blues and Shark Meat Pie and Riding to Babylon. I don't have the slightest idea when he became a separate person. He seemed real to me when I was writing as him, but only in the way all the stories I write seem real to me when I'm writing them, which is to say I take them seriously, but I don't believe them, except I do, then...
He paused and barked a bewildered little laugh.
All the times I've talked about writing, he said. Hundreds of lectures, thousands of classes. And I don't believe I ever said a single word about a fiction writer's grasp of the twin realities that exist for him. The one in the real world and the one in the manuscript world. I don't think I ever even thought about it. And now I realize, well, I don't even seem to know how to think about it.
It doesn't matter, Liz said. He didn't have to be a separate person until Thad tried to kill him.
Alan turned toward her.
Well, Liz, you know Thad better than anyone else. Did he change from Dr. Beaumont into Mr. Stark when he was working on the crime stories? Did he slap you around? Did he threaten people with a straight razor at parties?
Sarcasm isn't going to make this any easier to discuss, she said, looking at him steadily.
He threw up his hands in exasperation. Although he wasn't sure if it was them, himself, or all three of them he was exasperated with.
I'm not being sarcastic. I'm trying to use a little verbal shock treatment to make you see how crazy you both sound. You are talking about a goddamn pen name coming to life. If you tell the FBI even half of this stuff, they'll be looking up the state of Maine involuntary committal laws.
The answer to your question is no, Liz said. He didn't beat me up or wave a straight razor around at cocktail parties. But when he was writing as George Stark, and in particular when he was writing about Alexis Machine, Thad wasn't the same. When he opened the door, is maybe the best way to put it, when he did that and invited Stark in, he'd become distant. Not cold, not even cool, just distant. He was less interested in going out, in seeing people. He'd sometimes blow off faculty meetings, even student appointments, although that was fairly rare. He'd go to bed later at night, and sometimes he'd still be tossing and turning an hour after he did come to bed. When he fell asleep, he'd twitch and mutter a lot, as if he were having bad dreams. I asked him on a few occasions if that was the case, and he'd say he felt headachy and unrested. But if he'd been having bad dreams, he couldn't remember what they were. There was no big personality change, but he wasn't the same. My husband quit drinking alcohol some time ago, Alan. He doesn't go to Alcoholics Anonymous or anything, but he quit, with one exception. When one of the Stark novels was finished, he'd get drunk. Then it was as if he were blowing it all off, saying to himself, "The son of a bitch is gone again. At least for a while, he's gone again. George has returned to his farm in Mississippi. Hooray."
"She's got it right," Thad said. "Hooray. That's just what it felt like."
Let me sum up what we have if we leave the blackouts and the automatic writing out of the picture entirely. The man you're looking for is killing people I know, people who were, with the exception of Homer Gamache, responsible for executing George Stark, in conspiracy with me, of course. He's got my blood type, which isn't one of the really rare ones, but is still one that only about 6 people in every 100 have. He conforms to the description I gave you, which was a distillation of my own image of what George Stark would look like if he existed. He smokes the cigarettes I used to smoke. Last and most interesting, he appears to have fingerprints which are identical to mine. Maybe 6 in every 100 have type A blood with a negative Rh factor, but so far as we know, nobody else in this whole green world has my fingerprints. Despite all of this, you refuse to even consider my assertion that Stark is somehow alive. Now, Sheriff Alan Pangborn, you tell me. Who is the one who's operating in a fog, so to speak? Alan felt the bedrock, which he had once believed sure and solid, shift a little. It really wasn't possible, was it? But if he did nothing else today, he would have to speak to Thad's doctor and start chasing down the medical history. It occurred to him that it would be really wonderful to discover there hadn't been any brain tumor, that Thad had either lied about it or hallucinated it. If he could prove the man was a psycho, it would all be so much more comfortable. Maybe shit. There was no George Stark. There never had been any George Stark. He might not be an FBI whiz kid, but that didn't mean he was gullible enough to fall for that. They might collar the crazy bastard in New York City, going after Cowley. Probably would, in fact. But if not, the psycho might decide to vacation in Maine this summer. If he did come back, Alan wanted a shot at him. He didn't think swallowing any of this Twilight Zone shit would help him if the chance came up, and he didn't want to waste any more time talking about it now. "Time will tell, I suppose," he said vaguely. "For now, I'd advise you two to stick to the line you took with me last night. This is a guy who thinks he's George Stark, and he's crazy enough to have started at the logical place. Logical for a crazy man, anyway. The place where Stark was officially buried. If you don't at least allow the idea some mental house room, you're going to be in shit up to your armpits," Thad said. "This guy, Alan, you can't reason with him. You can't plead with him. You could beg him for mercy, if he gave you the time, but it wouldn't do any good. If you ever get close to him with your guard down, he will make shark meat pie out of you." "I'll check with your doctor," Alan said, "and with the doctor who operated on you as a kid. I don't know what good it will do or what light it might shed on this business, but I'll do it. Otherwise, I guess I'll just have to take my chances." Thad smiled with no humor whatsoever. "From my standpoint, there's a problem with that. My wife and kids and I will be taking our chances right along with you." 3. 15 minutes later, a trim blue-and-white panel truck pulled into Thad's driveway behind Alan's car. It looked like a telephone van, and that was what it turned out to be, although the words "Maine State Police" were written on the side in discreet lowercase letters. Two technicians came to the door, introduced themselves, apologized for having taken so long, an apology that was wasted on Thad and Liz, since they hadn't known these guys were coming at all, and asked Thad if he had any problems signing the form one of them carried on a clipboard. He scanned it quickly and saw it empowered them to place recording and traceback equipment on his phone. It did not give them blanket permission to use the transcripts obtained in any court proceeding. Thad scratched his signature in the proper place. Both Alan Pangborn and one of the technicians, Thad bemusedly noticed that he had a telephone tester slung on one side of his belt, a .45 on the other, witnessed it. "This traceback stuff really works?" Thad asked several minutes later, after Alan had left for the Orono State Police Barracks. It seemed important to say something. Following the return of their document, the technicians had fallen silent. "Yeah," one of them answered. He had picked the living room telephone out of its cradle and was rapidly levering off the handset's plastic inner sleeve. "We can trace a call back to its point of origination anywhere in the world. It's not like the old telephone traces you see in the movies, where you have to keep the caller on the line until the trace is done. As long as no one hangs up the phone on this end." He waggled the phone, which now looked a little like an android demolished by ray gun fire in a science fiction epic. "We can trace back to the point of origination, which more often than not turns out to be a pay telephone in a shopping mall." "You got that right," his partner said. He was doing something to the telephone jack, which he had removed from its baseboard plug. "You got a phone upstairs?" "Two of them," Thad said. He was beginning to feel as if someone had pushed him rudely down Alice's rabbit hole. "One in my study and one in the bedroom." "They on a separate line?" "No, we just have the one." "Where will you put the tape recorder?" "Probably down cellar," the first said absently. He was sticking wires from the telephone into a lucite block which bristled with spring connectors, and there was a would-you-mind-letting-us-do-our-job undertone to his voice. Thad put his arm around Liz's waist and guided her away, wondering if there was anyone who could or would understand that not all the tape recorders and high-tech state-of-the-art lucite blocks in the world would stop George Stark. Stark was out there, maybe resting up, maybe already on his way. and if no one would believe him, just what in the hell was he going to do about it? How in the hell was he supposed to protect his family? Was there a way? He thought deeply, and when thought accomplished nothing, he simply listened to himself. Sometimes, not always, but sometimes, the answer came that way when it would come no other. Not this time, though, and he was amused to find himself suddenly, desperately horny. He thought about coaxing Liz upstairs, and then remembered the state police technicians would shortly be up there, wanting to do more arcane things to his outmoded one-line telephones. Can't even get laid, he thought. So what do we do? But the answer was simple enough. They waited, that's what they did. Nor did they have to wait long for the next horrible tidbit. Stark had gotten Rick Cowley after all. Booby-trapped his door somehow after ambushing the technicians who had been doing the same thing to Rick's telephone that the men in the living room were doing to the Beaumonts. When Rick turned his latch key, the door simply blew up. It was Alan who brought them the news. He had gotten less than 3 miles down the road toward Orono when word of the explosion came over the radio. He had turned back immediately. "You told us Rick was safe," Liz said. Her voice and her eyes were dull. Even her hair seemed to have lost its luster. "You practically guaranteed it." "I was wrong, I'm sorry." Alan felt as deeply shocked as Liz Beaumont looked and sounded, but he was trying hard not to let it show. He glanced at Thad, who was looking back at him with a kind of bright-eyed stillness. A humorless little smile lurked just around the edges of Thad's mouth. "He knows just what I am thinking." This was probably not true, but it felt true to Alan. Well, maybe not everything, but some of it. Quite a bit of it, maybe. It could be that I'm doing a shitty job of covering up, but I don't think that's it. I think it's him. I think he sees too much. "You made an assumption that turned out to be wrong, that's all," Thad said. "Happens to the best of us. Maybe you ought to go back and think about George Stark a little more. What do you think, Alan?" "That you could be right," Alan said, and told himself he was only saying that to soothe both of them. But the face of George Stark, as yet unglimpsed except through Thad Beaumont's description, had begun to peer over his shoulder. He couldn't see it as yet, but he could feel it there, looking. "I want to talk with this Dr. Hurd. Hume," Thad said. "George Hume." "Thanks. I want to talk to him, so I'll be around. If the FBI does show up, would you two like me to drop back later on?" "I don't know about Thad, but I'd like that very much," Liz said. Thad nodded. Alan said, "I'm sorry about this whole thing, but the thing I'm sorriest about is promising you something would be okay when it turned out not to be." "In a situation like this, I guess it's easy to underestimate," Thad said. "I told you the truth, at least the truth as I understand it, for a simple reason. If it is Stark, I think a lot of people are going to underestimate him before this is over." Alan looked from Thad to Liz and back again. After a long time, during which there was no sound except for Thad's police guard talking together outside the front door, there was another around back, Alan said, "The bitch of it is, you guys really believe this, don't you?" Thad nodded. "I do, anyway." "I don't," Liz said, and they both looked at her, startled. "I don't believe. I know." Alan sighed and stuffed his hands deep into his pockets. "There's one thing I'd like to know," he said. "If this is what you say it is, I don't believe it, can't believe it, I suppose you'd say. But if it is, what the hell does this guy want? Just revenge?" "Not at all," Thad said. "He wants the same thing you or I would want if we were in his position. He wants not to be dead anymore. That's all he wants, not to be dead anymore. I'm the only one who might be able to make that happen. And if I can't or won't, well, he can at least make sure he isn't lonely." Chapter 16. George Stark Calling. 1. Alan had left to talk to Dr. Hume, and the FBI agents were just wrapping up their interrogation, if that was the right word for something which seemed so oddly exhausted and desultory, when George Stark rang. The call came less than 5 minutes after the state police technicians, who called themselves wiremen, finally pronounced themselves satisfied with the accessories they had attached to the Beaumont telephones. They had been disgusted, but apparently not very surprised, to find that beneath the state-of-the-art exterior of the Beaumont's Merlin phones, they were stuck with the town of Ludlow's horse-and-buggy rotary dial system. "Man, this is hard to believe," the wireman, whose name was Wes, said, in a tone of voice which suggested he really would have expected nothing else out here in East Overshoe. The other wireman, Dave, trudged out to the panel truck to find the proper adapters and any other equipment they might need to put the Beaumont's telephones in line with law enforcement as it exists in the latter years of the 20th century. Wes rolled his eyes and then looked at Thad, as if Thad should have informed him at once that he was still living in the telephone's pioneer era. Neither wireman spared so much as a glance for the FBI men who had flown up to Bangor from the Boston branch office and then driven heroically through the dangerous wolf and bear-infested wilderness between Bangor and Ludlow. The FBI men might have existed in an entirely different light spectrum, which state police wiremen could see no more than infrared or X-rays. "All the phones in town are this way," Thad said humbly. He was developing a nasty case of acid indigestion. Under ordinary circumstances, it would have made him grouchy and hard to live with. Today, however, he only felt tired and vulnerable and terribly sad. His thoughts kept turning to Rick's father, who lived in Tucson, and Miriam's parents, who lived in San Luis Obispo. What was old Mr. Cowley thinking about right now? What were the Penningtons thinking? How exactly would these people, often mentioned in conversation but never actually met, be managing? How did one cope not just with the death of one's child, but with the unexpected death of one's adult child? How did one cope with the simple, irrational fact of murder? Thad realized he was thinking of the survivors instead of the victims for one simple, gloomy reason. He felt responsible for everything. Why not? If he was not to blame for George Stark, who was? Bobcat Goldthwaite? Alexander Haig? The fact that the outdated rotary dial system still in use here made his phones unexpectedly difficult to tap was just something else to feel guilty about. "I think that's everything, Mr. Beaumont," one of the FBI men said. He had been reviewing his notes, apparently as oblivious of Wes and Dave as the two wiremen were of him. Now the agent, whose name was Malone, flipped his notebook closed. It was leather-bound, with his initials discreetly stamped in silver on the lower left-hand corner of the cover. He was dressed in a conservative gray suit, and his hair was parted ruler straight on the left. "Have you got anything else, Bill?" Bill, a.k.a. Agent Preble, flipped his own notebook, also leather-bound but sans initials, closed, and shook his head. "Nope, I think that about does it." Agent Preble was dressed in a conservative brown suit. His hair was also parted ruler straight on the left. "We may have a few more questions later on in the investigation, but we've got what we need for the time being. We'd like to thank you both for your cooperation." He gave them a big smile, disclosing teeth which were either capped or so perfect they were eerie, and Thad mused, "If we were five, I believe he'd give each of us a Today Was a Happy Face Day certificate to take home and show Mommy." "Not at all," Liz said in a slow, distracted voice. She was gently massaging her left temple with the tips of her fingers, as if she were experiencing the onset of a really bad headache. Probably, Thad thought, she is. He glanced at the clock on the mantel and saw it was just past 2:30. Was this the longest afternoon of his life? He didn't like to rush to such judgments, but he suspected it was. Liz stood. "I think I'm going to put my feet up for a while, if that's okay. I don't feel very chipper." "That's a good idea," was of course how he meant to finish, but before he could, the telephone rang. All of them looked at it, and Thad felt a pulse begin to trip hammer in his neck. A fresh bubble of acid, hot and burning, rose slowly in his chest and then seemed to spread out in the back of his throat. "Good deal," Wes said, pleased. "We won't have to send someone out to make a test call." Thad suddenly felt as if he were encased in an envelope of chilly air. It moved with him as he walked toward the telephone, which was now sharing its table with a gadget that looked like a lucite brick, with lights embedded in its side. One of the lights was pulsing in sync with the ringing of the telephone. "Where are the birds? I should be hearing the birds." But there were none.
The only sound was the Merlin phone's demanding warble. Wes was kneeling by the fireplace and putting tools back into a black case, which, with its oversized chrome latches, resembled a workman's dinner bucket. Dave was leaning in the doorway between the living room and the dining room. He had asked Liz if he could have a banana from the bowl on the table, and was now peeling it thoughtfully, pausing every now and then to examine his work with the critical eye of an artist in the throes of creation.
"Get the circuit tester, why don't you?" he said to Wes. "If we need some line clarification, we can do it while we're right here. Might save a trip back."
"Good idea," Wes said, and plucked something with a pistol grip out of the oversized dinner bucket. Both men looked mildly expectant and no more. Agents Malone and Preble were standing, replacing notebooks, shaking out the knife-edge creases in the legs of their pants, and generally confirming Thad's original opinion. These men seemed more like H&R Block tax consultants than gun-toting G-men. Malone and Preble seemed totally unaware the phone was ringing at all. But Liz knew. She had stopped rubbing her temple and was looking at Thad with the wide, haunted eyes of an animal which has been brought to bay. Preble was thanking her for the coffee and Danish she had supplied, and seemed as unaware of her failure to answer him as he was of the ringing telephone.
"What is the matter with you people?" Thad suddenly felt like screaming. "What in the hell did you set up all this equipment for in the first place?"
Unfair, of course. For the man they were after to be the first person to phone the Beaumonts after the tap-and-trace equipment had been set up, a bare 5 minutes after installation was complete, in fact, was just too fortuitous. Or so they would have said if anyone had bothered to ask them. Things don't happen that way in the wonderful world of law enforcement as it exists in the latter years of the 20th century, they would have said. "It's another writer calling you up for a nice fresh plot idea, Thad. Or maybe someone wants to know if your wife could spare a cup of sugar. But the guy who thinks he's your alter ego? No way, Jose. Too soon. Too lucky." Except it was Stark. Thad could smell him. And, looking at his wife, he knew that Liz could, too. Now Wes was looking at him, no doubt wondering why Thad didn't answer his freshly rigged phone. "Don't worry," Thad thought. "Don't worry, he'll wait. He knows we're home, you see."
"Well, we'll just get out of your hair, Mrs. Bo—"
Preble began, and Liz said in a calm but terribly pained voice, "I think you'd better wait, please." Thad picked up the telephone and shouted,
"What do you want, you son of a bitch? Just what the fuck do you want?"
Wes jumped. Dave froze just as he was preparing to take the first bite from his banana. The heads of the federal agents snapped around. Thad found himself wishing with miserable intensity that Alan Pangborn were here instead of talking to Dr. Hume up in Orono. Alan didn't believe in Stark either, at least not yet, but at least he was human. Thad supposed these others might be, but he had serious doubts as to whether or not they knew he and Liz were.
"It's him. It's him," Liz was saying to Preble.
"Oh, Jesus," Preble said. He and the other fearless minion of the law exchanged an utterly nonplussed glance. "What the fuck do we do now?" Thad heard and saw these things, but was separate from them. Separate even from Liz. There were only Stark and him now. Together again for the first time, as the old vaudeville announcers used to say.
"Cool down, Thad," George Stark said.
He sounded amused.
"No need to get your panties all in a bunch."
It was the voice he had expected. Exactly. Every nuance, right down to the faint southern slur that turned "get your" into something that was not "getcho," but wanted to be. The two wiremen put their heads together briefly, and then Dave bolted for the panel truck and the auxiliary telephone. He was still holding his banana. Wes ran for the cellar stairs to check the voice-activated tape recorder. The fearless minions of the FBI stood in the middle of the living room and stared. They looked as if they wanted to put their arms about each other for comfort, like babes lost in the woods.
"What do you want?" Thad repeated in a quieter voice. "Why, just to tell you that it is over," Stark said. "I got the last one this noontime. That little girl who used to work at Darwin Press for the boss of the accounting department."
Almost, but not quite,
"the accounting department."
She was the one got that Clawson boy's coffee perkin in the first place, Stark said. The cops'll find her. She's got a place on 2nd Avenue way downtown. Some of her's on the floor. I put the rest on the kitchen table.
He laughed.
It's been a busy week, Thad. I've been hopping as fast as a one-legged man in an ass-kicking contest. I just called to set your mind at rest.
It doesn't feel very rested, Thad said.
Well, give it time, old hoss, give it time. I think I'll head down south, do me some fishing. This city life tires me out.
He laughed, a sound so monstrously jolly it made Thad's flesh crawl. He was lying. Thad knew this as surely as he knew that Stark had waited until the tap and trace equipment was in place to make his call. Could he know something like that? The answer was yes. Stark might be calling from somewhere in New York City, but the two of them were tied together by the same invisible but undeniable bond that connected twins. They were twins, halves of the same whole, and Thad was terrified to find himself drifting out of his body, drifting along the phone line. Not all the way to New York, no, but halfway, meeting the monster at the center of this umbilicus, in western Massachusetts, perhaps. The two of them meeting and merging again, as they had somehow met and merged every time he had put the cover on his typewriter and picked up one of those goddamned barrel Black Beauty pencils.
"You lying fuck!" he cried.
The FBI agents jumped as if they had been goosed.
"Hey, Thad, that's not very nice," Stark said.
He sounded injured.
"Did you think I was going to hurt you?" "Hell no, I was getting revenge for you, boy. I knew I was the one had to do it. I know you got a chicken liver, but I don't hold it against you. It takes all kinds to spin a world as busy as this one. Why in hell would I bother to revenge you if I was going to fix things so you couldn't enjoy it?"
Thad's fingers had gone to the small white scar on his forehead and were rubbing there, rubbing hard enough to redden the skin. He found himself trying desperately to hold on to himself, to hold on to his own basic reality. "He's lying, and I know why, and he knows I know, and he knows it doesn't matter because no one will believe me. He knows how odd it all looks to them, and he knows they're listening. He knows what they think, but he also knows how they think, and that makes him safe. They believe he's a psycho who only thinks he's George Stark, because that's what they have to think. To think in any other way goes against everything they've learned, everything they are. All the fingerprints in the world won't change that. He knows that if he implies he's not George Stark, if he implies that he's finally figured that out, they'll relax. They won't remove the police protection right away, but he can speed it up.
You know whose idea it was to bury you. It was mine.
No, no, Stark said easily, and it was almost, but not quite, no, no.
You were misled, that's all. When that slimeball Clawson came along, he knocked you for a loop. That's the way it was. Then when you called up that trained monkey who called himself a literary agent, he gave you some real bad advice. Thad, it was like someone took a big crap on your dining room table, and you called up someone you trusted to ask him what to do about it, and that someone said, you haven't got a problem, just put you some pork gravy on it. Shit with pork gravy on it tastes right fine on a cold night. You never would have done what you did on your own. I know that, hoss.
That's a goddamn lie, and you know it.
And suddenly he realized just how perfect this was, and how well Stark understood the people he was dealing with. He's going to come right out and say it pretty soon. He's going to come right out and say that he isn't George Stark. And they'll believe him when he does. They'll listen to the tape that's turning down in the basement right now, and they'll believe what it says, Alan and everyone else. Because that's not just what they want to believe. It's what they already believe.
I don't know any such thing, Stark said calmly, almost amiably. I'm not going to bother you anymore, Thad, but let me give you at least one chunk of advice before I go. It may do you some good. Don't you get thinking I'm George Stark. That's the mistake I made. I had to go and kill a whole bunch of people just to get my head squared around again.
Thad listened to this, thunderstruck.
There were things he should be saying, but he couldn't seem to get past this weird feeling of disconnection from his body and his amazement at the pure and perfect gall of the man. He thought of the futile conversation with Alan Pangborn and wondered again who he was when he made up Stark, who had started off being just another story to him. Where exactly was the line of belief? Had he created this monster by losing that line somehow? Or was there some other factor, an X factor, which he could not see but only hear in the cries of those phantom birds?
I don't know, Stark was saying with an easy laugh. Maybe I actually am as crazy as they said I was when I was in that place.
Oh, good, that's good. Get them checking the insane asylums in the South for a tall, broad-shouldered man with blonde hair. That won't divert all of them, but it will do for a start, won't it?
Thad clenched the phone tight, his head throbbing with sick fury now.
But I'm not a bit sorry I did it, because I did love those books, Thad. When I was there, in that loony bin, I think they were the only things kept me sane. And you know something? I feel a lot better now. I know for sure who I am now, and that's something. I believe you could call what I did therapy, but I don't think there's much future in it, do you?
Quit lying, goddammit, Thad shouted.
We could discuss this, Stark said. We could discuss it all the way to hell and back, but it'd take a while.
I guess they told you to keep me on the line, didn't they?
No, they don't need you on the line, and you know that too.
Give my best regards to your lovely wife, Stark said, with a touch of what almost sounded like reverence. Take care of your babies, and you take it easy your own self, Thad. I'm not going to bother you anymore. It's...
What about the birds? Thad asked suddenly.
Do you hear the birds, George?
There was a sudden silence on the line. Thad seemed to feel a quality of surprise in it, as if, for the first time in the conversation, something had not gone according to George Stark's carefully prepared script. He did not know exactly why, but it was as if his nerve endings possessed some arcane understanding the rest of him did not have. He felt a moment of wild triumph, the sort of triumph an amateur boxer might feel, slipping one past Mike Tyson's guard and momentarily rocking the champ back on his heels.
George, do you hear the birds?
The only sound in the room was the tick of the clock on the mantelpiece. Liz and the FBI agents were staring at him.
I don't know what you're talking about, Hoss, Stark said slowly.
Could be you.
No, Thad said, and laughed wildly. His fingers continued to rub the small white scar, shaped vaguely like a question mark on his forehead.
No, you don't know what I'm talking about, do you? Well, you listen to me for a minute, George. I hear the birds. I don't know what they mean yet, but I will. And when I do...
But that was where the words stopped. When he did, what would happen? He didn't know. The voice on the other end said slowly, with great deliberation and emphasis,
"Whatever you are talking about, Thad, it doesn't matter, because this is over now."
There was a click. Stark was gone. Thad almost felt himself being yanked back along the telephone line from that mythical meeting place in western Massachusetts, yanked along not at the speed of sound or light, but at that of thought, and thumped rudely back into his own body, Stark naked again.
Jesus.
He dropped the phone, and it hit the cradle askew. He turned around on legs which felt like stilts, not bothering to replace it properly. Dave rushed into the room from one direction, Wes from another.
It worked perfect, Wes screamed.
The FBI agents jumped once more. Malone made an eek noise very much like the one attributed to women in comic strips who have just spotted mice.
Thad tried to imagine what these two would be like in a confrontation with a gang of terrorists or shotgun-toting bank robbers, and couldn't do it.
Maybe I'm just too tired, he thought. The two wiremen did a clumsy little dance, slapping each other on the back, and then raced out to the equipment van together.
It was him, Thad said to Liz.
He said he wasn't. But it was him.
Him.
She came to him then and hugged him tightly, and he needed that.
He hadn't known how badly until she did it.
"I know," she whispered in his ear,
and he put his face into her hair and closed his eyes. 2. The shouting had wakened the twins. They were both crying lustily upstairs. Liz went to get them. Thad started to follow her, then returned to set the telephone properly into its cradle. It rang at once. Alan Pangborn was on the other end. He had stopped in at the Orono State Police Barracks to have a cup of coffee before his appointment with Dr. Hume, and had been there when Dave the wireman radioed in with news of the call and the preliminary trace results. Alan sounded very excited. "We don't have a complete trace yet, but we know it was New York City, area code 212, he said. 5 minutes and we'll have the location nailed down. "It was him," Dad repeated. "It was Stark. He said he wasn't, but that's who it was. Someone has to check on the girl he mentioned. The name is probably Darla Gates."
"The slut from Vassar with the bad nasal habits?"
"Right," Thad said, although he doubted if Darla Gates would be worrying about her nose much anymore, one way or the other. He felt intensely weary. "I'll pass the name on to the NYPD. How you doing, Thad?"
"I'm all right."
"Liz?"
"Never mind the bedside manner just now, okay? Did you hear what I said? It was him. No matter what he said, it was him."
"Well, why don't we just wait and see what comes of the trace?" There was something in his voice Thad hadn't heard there before. Not the sort of cautious incredulity he'd evinced when he first realized the Beaumonts were talking about George Stark as a real guy, but actual embarrassment. It was a realization Thad would happily have spared himself, but it was simply too clear in the sheriff's voice. Embarrassment, and of a very special sort. The kind you felt for someone too distraught or stupid or maybe just too self-insensitive to feel it for himself. Thad felt a twinkle of sour amusement at the idea.
"Okay, we'll wait and see," Thad agreed.
"And while we're waiting and seeing, I hope you'll go ahead and keep your appointment with my doctor." Pangborn was replying, something about making another call first, but all of a sudden Thad didn't much care. The acid was percolating up from his stomach again, and this time it was a volcano. Foxy George, he thought. They think they see through him. He wants them to think that. He is watching them see through him, and when they go away, far enough away, Foxy old George will arrive in his black Toronado. And what am I going to do to stop him? He didn't know. He hung up the telephone, cutting off Alan Pangborn's voice, and went upstairs to help Liz change the twins and dress them for the afternoon. And he kept thinking about how it had felt. How it had felt to be somehow trapped in a telephone line running beneath the countryside of western Massachusetts. Trapped down there in the dark, with foxy old George Stark. It had felt like Ennsville.
3. 10 minutes later, the phone rang again. It stopped halfway through the second ring, and Wes the wireman called Thad to the phone. He went downstairs to take the call.
"Where are the FBI agents?" he asked Wes. For a moment, he really expected Wes to say, "FBI agents? I didn't see any FBI agents."
"Them? They left."
Wes gave a big shrug, as if to ask Thad if he had expected anything else.
"They got all these computers, and if someone doesn't play with them, I guess someone else wonders how come there's so much downtime, and they might have to take a budget cut or something."
"Do they do anything?"
"Nope," Wes said simply. "Not in cases like these. Or if they do, I've never been around when they did it. They write stuff down, they do that. Then they put it in a computer someplace, like I said."
"I see." Wes looked at his watch.
"Me and Dave are out of here, too. Equipment will run on its own. You won't even get a bill."
"Good," Thad said, going to the phone.
"And thank you."
"No problem.
Mr. Beaumont?"
Thad turned.
"If I was to read one of your books, would you say I'd do better with one you wrote under your own name, or one under the other guy's name?"
"Try the other guy," Thad said, picking up the phone. "More action."
Wes nodded, sketched a salute, and went out. "Hello," Thad said. He felt as if he should have a telephone grafted onto the side of his head soon. It would save time and trouble. With recording and traceback equipment attached, of course, he could carry it around in a backpack.
"Hi, Thad. Alan. I'm still at the State Police Barracks. Listen, the news is not so good on the phone trace. Your friend called from a telephone kiosk in Penn Station." Thad remembered what the other wireman, Dave, had said about installing all that expensive high-tech equipment in order to trace a call back to a bank of phones in a shopping mall somewhere.
"Are you surprised?"
"No. Disappointed, but not surprised. We hope for a slip, and believe it or not, we usually get one, sooner or later. I'd like to come over tonight. That okay?"
"Okay," Thad said. "Why not? If things get dull, we'll play bridge."
"We expect to have voice prints by this evening."
"So you get his voice print, so what?"
"Not print, prints.
A voice print is a computer-generated graphic which accurately represents a person's vocal qualities," Pangborn said. "It doesn't have anything to do with speech, exactly. We're not interested in accents, impediments, pronunciation, that sort of thing. What the computer synthesizes is pitch and tone, what the experts call head voice, and timbre and resonance, which is known as chest or gut voice. They are verbal fingerprints, and like fingerprints, no one has ever found two which are exactly alike. I'm told that the difference in the voice prints of identical twins is much wider than the difference in their fingerprints." He paused. "We've sent a high-resolution copy of the tape we got to Fole in Washington. What we'll get is a comparison of your voice print and his voice print. The guys at the State Police Barracks here wanted to tell me I was crazy. I could see it in their faces, but after the fingerprints and your alibi, no one quite had the nerve to come right out and say it." Thad opened his mouth, tried to speak, couldn't, wet his lips, tried again, and still couldn't.
"Thad, are you hanging up on me again?"
"No," he said, and all at once there seemed to be a cricket in the middle of his voice. "Thank you, Alan."
"No, don't say that. I know what you're thanking me for, and I don't want to mislead you. All I'm trying to do is follow standard investigatory procedure. The procedure is a little odd in this case, granted, because the circumstances are a little odd. That doesn't mean you should make unwarranted assumptions. Get me?"
"Yes. What's Fole?"
Oh, the Federal Office of Law Enforcement. Maybe the only good thing Nixon did the whole damn time he was in the White House. It's mostly made up of computer banks that serve as a central clearinghouse for the local law enforcement agencies. And the program crunchers who run them, of course. We can access the fingerprints of almost anyone in America convicted of a felony crime since 1969 or so. Fole also supplies ballistics reports for comparison, blood typing on felons where available, voice prints, and computer-generated pictures of suspected criminals.
So we'll see if my voice and his...
Yes. We should have it by 7, 8 if there's heavy computer traffic down there.
Thad was shaking his head.
We didn't sound anything alike.
I heard the tape, and I know that, Pangborn said.
Let me repeat. A voice print has absolutely nothing to do with speech. Head voice and gut voice, Thad. There's a big difference. But tell me something. Do Elmer Fudd and Daffy Duck sound the same to you?
Thad blinked.
Well, no. Not to me either, Pangborn said. But a guy named Mel Blanc does both of them. Not to mention the voices of Bugs Bunny, Tweety Bird, Foghorn Leghorn, and God knows how many others. I've got to go. See you tonight, okay?
Yes.
Between 7:30 and 9, all right?
We'll look for you, Alan.
Okay. However this goes, I'll be heading back to the Rock tomorrow, and barring some unforeseen break in the case, there I will remain.
The finger, having writ, moves on, right? Thad said, and thought, that's what he's counting on, after all.
Yeah, I've got lots of other fish to fry. None are as big as this one, but the people of Castle County pay my salary for frying them. You know what I mean?
This seemed to Thad to be a serious question and not just a placeholder in the conversation.
Yes, I do know.
We both do. Me
and Foxy George.
I'll have to go, but you'll see a state police cruiser parked out in front of your house 24 hours a day until this thing is over. Those guys are tough, Thad. And if the cops in New York let down their guards a little, the bears you got watching out for you won't. No one is going to underestimate this spook again. No one is going to forget you or leave you and your family to cope with this on your own. People will be working on this case, and while they do, other people will be watching out for you and yours. You understand that, don't you?
Yes, I understand. And thought, today, tomorrow, next week, maybe next month. But next year? No way. I know it, and he knows it too. Right now, they don't completely believe what he said about coming to his senses and laying off. Later on, they will. As the weeks pass and nothing happens, it will become more than politic for them to believe it. It will also become economic. Because George and I know how the world goes rolling around the sun in its accustomed groove. Just as we know that, as soon as everybody is busy frying those other fish, George will show up and fry me. Us.
4. 15 minutes later, Alan was still in the Orono State Police Barracks, still on the telephone and still on hold. There was a click on the line. A young woman spoke to him in a slightly apologetic tone.
"Can you hold a little longer, Chief Pangborn? The computer is having one of its slow days."
Alan considered telling her he was a sheriff, not a chief, and then didn't bother. It was a mistake everyone made. "Sure," he said. Click. He was returned to hold, that latter 20th century version of limbo. He was sitting in a cramped little office all the way to the rear of the barracks. Any farther back, and he would have been doing business in the bushes. The room was filled with dusty files. The only desk was a grammar school refugee. The type with a sloping surface, a hinged lid, and an inkwell. Alan balanced it on his knees and swung it idly back and forth that way. At the same time, he turned the piece of paper on the desk around and around. Written on it, in Alan's small, neat hand, were two pieces of information. Hugh Pritchard and Bergenfield County Hospital, Bergenfield, New Jersey. He thought of his last conversation with Thad, half an hour ago, the one where he had told him all about how the brave state troopers were going to protect him and his wife from the bad old crazy man who thought he was George Stark, if the bad old crazy man showed up. Alan wondered if Thad had believed it. He doubted it. He guessed that a man who wrote fiction for a living would have a keen nose for fairy tales. Well, they would try to protect Thad and Liz, give them that. But Alan kept remembering something which had happened in Bangor in 1985. A woman had requested and had received police protection after her estranged husband had beaten her severely and threatened to come back and kill her if she went through with her plans for a divorce. For 2 weeks, the man had done nothing. The Bangor PD had been about to cancel the watch when the husband showed up, driving a laundry truck and wearing green fatigues with the laundry's name on the back of the shirt. He had walked up to the door, carrying a bundle of laundry. The police might have recognized the man, even in the uniform, if he had come earlier, when the watch order was fresh, but that was moot. They hadn't recognized him when he did show up. He knocked on the door, and when the woman opened it, her husband pulled a gun out of his pants pocket and shot her dead. Before the cops assigned it to her had fully realized what was happening, let alone got out of their car, the man had been standing on the stoop with his hands raised. He had tossed the smoking gun into the rose bushes. "Don't shoot me," he said calmly. "I'm finished." The truck and the uniform, it turned out, had been borrowed from an old drinking buddy who didn't even know the perp had been fighting with his wife. The point was simple. If someone wanted you badly enough, and if that someone had just a little luck, he would get you. Look at Oswald. Look at Chapman. Look what this fellow Stark had done to those people in New York. Click.
"Are you still there, Chief?" the female voice from Bergenfield County Hospital asked brightly.
"Yes," he said, "still right here."
"I have the information you requested," she said. "Dr. Hugh Pritchard retired in 1978. I have an address and telephone number for him in the town of Fort Laramie, Wyoming."
"May I have it, please?" She gave it to him.
Alan thanked her, hung up, and dialed the number. The telephone uttered half a ring, then an answering machine cut in and began spieling its recorded announcement into Alan's ear.
"Hello, this is Hugh Pritchard," a gravelly voice said.
Well, Alan thought, the guy isn't croaked anyway. That's a step in the right direction.
Helga and I aren't in right now. I'm probably playing golf. God knows what Helga's up to.
There was an old man's rusty chuckle.
If you got a message, please leave it at the sound of the tone. You've got about 30 seconds.
Beep.
Dr. Pritchard, this is Sheriff Alan Pangborn, he said. I'm a law enforcement officer in Maine. I need to talk to you about a man named Thad Beaumont. You removed a lesion from his brain in 1960 when he was 11. Please call me collect at the Orono State Police Barracks. 207-555-2121. Thank you.
He finished in a mild sweat. Talking to answering machines always made him feel like a contestant on Beat the Clock. Why are you even bothering with all this?
The answer he had given Thad was a simple one. Procedure. Alan himself could not be satisfied with such a pat answer because he knew it wasn't procedure. It might have been, conceivably, if this Pritchard had operated on the man calling himself Stark. Except he's not anymore. Now he says he knows who he really is. But he hadn't. He had operated on Beaumont, and in any case, that had been 28 long years ago. So why? Because none of it was right, that was why. The fingerprints weren't. The blood type obtained from the cigarette ends wasn't. The combination of cleverness and homicidal rage which their man had displayed wasn't. Thad's and Liz's insistence that the pen name was real wasn't. That most of all. That was the assertion of a couple of lunatics. And now he had something else which wasn't right. The state police accepted the man's assertion that he now understood who he really was without a qualm. To Alan, it had all the authenticity of a $3 bill. It screamed trick, ruse, runaround. Alan thought maybe the man was still coming. But none of that answers the question, his mind whispered. Why are you bothering with all this? Why are you calling Fort Laramie, Wyoming, and chasing down an old doc who probably doesn't remember Thad Beaumont from a hole in the wall? Because I don't have anything better to do, he answered himself irritably. Because I can call from here without the town selectmen bitching about the goddamn long-distance charges. And because they believe it, Thad and Liz. It's crazy, all right, but they seem sane enough otherwise. And goddammit, they believe it. That doesn't mean I do.
And he didn't.
Did he?
The day passed slowly. Dr. Pritchard didn't call back, but the voice prints came in shortly after 8 o'clock. And the voice prints were amazing.
5. They weren't what Thad had expected at all. He had expected a sheet of graph paper covered with spiky mountains and valleys which Alan would try to explain. He and Liz would nod wisely, as people did when someone was explaining a thing too complex for them to understand, knowing that if they did ask questions, the explanations which followed would be even less comprehensible. Instead, Alan showed them two sheets of plain white paper. A single line ran across the middle of each. There were a few groups of spike points, always in pairs or trios, but for the most part the lines were peaceful, if rather irregular, sine waves. And you only had to look from one to the other with the naked eye to see that they were either identical or very close to it.
That's it? Liz asked.
Not quite, Alan said. Watch. He slid one sheet on top of the other. He did this with the air of a magician performing an exceptionally fine trick. He held the two sheets up to the light. Thad and Liz stared at the doubled sheets.
They really are, Liz said in a soft, awed voice. They're just the same.
Well, not quite, Alan said, and pointed at three spots where the voice print line on the undersheet showed through the tiniest bit. One of these show-throughs was above the line on the top sheet, the other two below. In all three cases, the show-through was in places where the line spiked. The sine wave itself seemed to match perfectly.
The differences are in Thad's print, and they come only at stress points.
Alan tapped each show-through in turn.
Here. What do you want, you son of a bitch? Just what the fuck do you want? And here. That's a goddamn lie, and you know it. And finally, here. Quit lying, goddammit. Right now, everyone's focusing on these three minute differences because they want to hang on to their assumption that no two voice prints are ever alike. But the fact is, there weren't any stress points in Stark's part of the conversation. The bastard stayed cool, calm, and collected all the way through.
"Yeah," Thad said. He sounded like he was drinking lemonade.
Alan put the voice prints down on an end table.
"Nobody at State Police Headquarters really believes these are two different voice prints, even with the minute differences," he said. "We got the prints back from Washington very fast. The reason I'm so late is because after the expert in Augusta saw them, he wanted a copy of the tape. We sent it down on an Eastern Airlines commuter flight out of Bangor, and they ran it through a gadget called an audio enhancer. They use it to tell if someone actually spoke the words under investigation or if they're listening to a voice which was on tape."
"Is it live or is it Memorex?" Thad said. He was sitting by the fireplace, drinking a soda. Liz had returned to the playpen after looking at the voice prints. She was sitting cross-legged on the floor, trying to keep William and Wendy from wrapping their heads together as they examined each other's toes.
"Why did they do that?"
Alan cocked a thumb at Thad, who was grinning sourly.
"Your husband knows."
Thad asked Alan, "With the little differences in the spikes, they can at least kid themselves that two different voices were speaking, even if they know better. That was your point, wasn't it?"
"Uh-huh. Even though I've never heard of voice prints even remotely as close as these."
He shrugged. "Granted, my experience with them isn't as wide as the guys at Full who study them for a living, or even the guys in Augusta who are more or less general practitioners. Voice prints, fingerprints, footprints, tire prints. But I do read the literature, and I was there when the results came back, Thad. They are kidding themselves, yes, but they're not doing it very hard."
"So they've got three small differences, but they're not enough. The problem is that my voice was stressed and Stark's wasn't. So they went to this enhancer thing hoping for a fallback position, hoping, in fact, that Stark's end of the conversation would turn out to be a tape recording, made by me."
He cocked an eyebrow at Alan.
"Do I win the stewing chicken?"
"Not only that, you win the glassware for six and the free trip to Kittery."
"That's the craziest thing I ever heard," Liz said flatly.
Thad laughed without much humor.
"The whole thing is crazy. They thought I might have changed my voice like Rich Little or Mel Blanc. The idea is that I made a tape in my George Stark voice, building in pauses where I could reply in front of witnesses in my own voice. Of course, I'd have to buy a gadget that could hook a cassette tape recorder into a pay telephone. There are such things, aren't there, Alan?"
"You bet. Available at fine electronics supply houses everywhere. Or just dial the 800 number that will appear on your screen. Operators are standing by."
"Right. The only other thing I'd need would be an accomplice, someone I trusted who would go to Penn Station, attach the tape player to a phone in the bank which looked like it was doing the least business, and dial my house at the proper time. Then—"
He broke off.
"How was the call paid for? I forgot about that. It wasn't collect."
"Your telephone credit card number was used," Alan said. "You obviously gave it to your accomplice."
"Yeah, obviously. I only had to do two things once this shuck and jive got started. One was to make sure I answered the telephone myself. The other was to remember my lines and plug them into the correct pauses. I did very well, wouldn't you say, Alan?"
"Yeah, fantastic."
"My accomplice hangs up the telephone when the script says he should. He unhooks the tape player from the phone, tucks it under his arm."
"Hell, slips it into his pocket," Alan said. "The stuff they've got now is so good even the CIA buys at Radio Shack."
"Okay, he slips it into his pocket and just walks away. The result is a conversation where I am both seen and heard to be talking to a man 500 miles away, a man who sounds different, who sounds, in fact, just the tiniest bit Southern fried, but has the same voice print as I do. It's the fingerprints all over again, only better."
He looked at Alan for confirmation.
"On second thought," Alan said, "make that an all-expense-paid trip to Portsmouth."
"Thank you. Don't mention it."
"That's not just crazy," Liz said. "It's utterly incredible. I think all those people should have their heads—"
While her attention was diverted, the twins finally succeeded in knocking their own heads together and began to cry lustily.
Liz picked up William. Thad rescued Wendy. When the crisis passed, Alan said, "It's incredible, all right. You know it, I know it, and they know it too. But Conan Doyle had Sherlock Holmes say at least one thing that still holds true in crime detection. When you eliminate all the impossible explanations, whatever is left is your answer, no matter how improbable it may be."
"I think the original was a little more elegant," Thad said.
Alan grinned. "Screw you."
"You two may find this funny, but I don't," Liz said. "Thad would have to be crazy to do something like that. Of course, the police may think we're both crazy."
"They don't think any such thing," Alan replied gravely. "At least not at this point, and they won't as long as you go on keeping your wilder tales to yourselves."
"What about you, Alan?" Thad asked.
"We've spilled all the wild tales to you. What do you think?"
"Not that you're crazy. All of this would be a lot simpler if I did believe it. I don't know what's going on."
"What did you get from Dr. Hume?" Liz wanted to know.
"The name of the doctor who operated on Thad when he was a kid," Alan said. "It's Hugh Pritchard. Does that ring a bell, Thad?"
Thad frowned and thought it over. At last he said, "I think it does, but I might only be kidding myself. It was a long time ago."
Liz was leaning forward, bright-eyed. William goggled at Alan from the safety of his mother's lap.
"What did Pritchard tell you?" she asked.
"Nothing. I got his answering machine, which allows me to deduce that the man is still alive, and that's all. I left a message."
Liz settled back in her chair, clearly disappointed.
"What about my tests?" Thad asked. "Did Hume have anything back? Or wouldn't he tell you?"
"He said that when he had the results, you'd be the first to know," Alan said. He grinned. "Dr. Hume seemed rather offended at the idea of telling a county sheriff anything."
"That's George Hume," Thad said and smiled. "Krusty is his middle name."
Alan shifted in his seat.
"Would you like something to drink, Alan?" Liz asked. "A beer or a Pepsi?"
"No, thanks. Let's go back to what the state police do and do not believe. They don't believe either of you is involved, but they reserve the right to believe you might be. They know they can't hang last night's and this morning's work on you, Thad. An accomplice, maybe. The same one, hypothetically, who would have worked the tape recorder gag. But not you. You were here."
"What about Darla Gates?" Thad asked quietly.
"The girl who worked in the comptroller's office?"
"Dead. Mutilated pretty badly, as he suggested, but shot once through the head first. She didn't suffer."
"That's a lie." Alan blinked at him. "He didn't let her off so cheaply. Not after what he did to Clausen. After all, she was the original stoolie, wasn't she? Clausen dangled some money in front of her. It couldn't have been very much, judging from the state of Clausen's finances. And she obliged by letting the cat out of the bag. So don't tell me he shot her before he cut her and that she didn't suffer."
"All right," Alan said. "It wasn't like that. Do you want to know how it really was?"
"No," Liz said immediately.
There was a moment of heavy silence in the room. Even the twins seemed to feel it. They looked at each other with what seemed to be great solemnity. At last Thad asked,
"Let me ask you again. What do you believe? What do you believe now?"
"I don't have a theory. I know you didn't tape Stark's end of the conversation because the enhancer didn't detect any tape hiss. And when you jack up the audio, you can hear the Penn Station loudspeaker announcing that the Pilgrim to Boston is now ready for boarding on track number 3. The Pilgrim did board on track 3 this afternoon. Boarding started at 2:36 p.m., and that's right in line with your little chat. But I didn't even need that. If the conversation had been taped on Stark's end, either you or Liz would have asked me what the enhancing process showed as soon as I brought it up. Neither of you did."
"All this, and you still don't believe it, do you?" Thad said.
"I mean, it's got you rocking and rolling, enough so you really are trying to chase down Dr. Pritchard. But you really can't get all the way to the middle of what's happening, can you?"
He sounded frustrated and harried, even to himself.
The guy himself admitted he wasn't Stark.
"Oh, yes, he was very sincere about it, too,"
Thad laughed.
"You act as though that doesn't surprise you."
"It doesn't."
"Does it surprise you?"
"Frankly, yes, it does."
After going to such great pains to establish the fact that you and he share the same fingerprints, the same voice prints.
Alan, stop a second, Thad said.
Alan did, looking at Thad inquiringly.
I told you this morning that I thought George Stark was doing these things. Not an accomplice of mine. Not a psycho who has somehow managed to invent a way to wear other people's fingerprints, between his murderous fits and identity fugues, that is. And you didn't believe me. Do you now?
No, Thad. I wish I could tell you differently, but the best I can do is this. I believe that you believe. He shifted his gaze to take in Liz. Both of you.
I'll settle for the truth, since anything less is apt to get me killed, Thad said. And my family along with me, more likely than not. At this point, it does my heart good just to hear you say you don't have a theory. It's not much, but it's a step forward. What I was trying to show you is that the fingerprints and voice prints don't make a difference, and Stark knows it. You can talk all you want about throwing away the impossible and accepting whatever is left, no matter how improbable, but it doesn't work that way. You don't accept Stark, and he's what's left when you eliminate the rest. Let me put it this way, Alan. If you had this much evidence of a tumor in your brain, you would go into the hospital and have an operation. Even if the odds were good, you'd not come out alive.
Alan opened his mouth, shook his head, and snapped it shut again. Other than the clock and the soft babble and coo of the twins, there was no sound in the living room, where Thad was rapidly coming to feel he had spent his entire adult life.
On one hand, you have enough hard evidence to make a strong circumstantial court case, Thad resumed softly. On the other, you have the unsubstantiated assertion of a voice on the phone that he's come to his senses, that he knows who he is now. Yet you're going to ignore the evidence in favor of the assertion.
No, Thad, that's not true. I'm not accepting any assertions right now. Not yours, not your wife's, and least of all the ones made by the man who called on the phone. All my options are still open.
Thad jerked a thumb over his shoulder at the window. Beyond the gently wavering drapes, they could see the state police car that belonged to the troopers who were watching the Beaumont house. What about them? Are all their options still open? I wish to Christ you were staying here, Alan. I'd take you over an army of state troopers because you've at least got one eye half open. Theirs are stuck shut.
Thad,
never mind. Thad said, it's true, you know it. And he knows it, too. He'll wait. And when everybody decides it's over and the Beaumonts are safe, when all the police fold their tents and move on, George Stark will come here.
He paused, his face a dark and complicated study. Alan saw regret, determination, and fear at work in that face.
I'm going to tell you something now. I'm going to tell both of you. I know exactly what he wants. He wants me to write another novel under the Stark byline. Probably another novel about Alexis Machine. I don't know if I could do that, but if I thought it would do any good, I'd try. I'd trash the Golden Dog and start tonight.
Thad, no, Liz cried.
Don't worry, he said. It would kill me. Don't ask me how I know that, I just do. But if my death was the end of it, I still might try. But I don't think it would be. Because I don't really think he is a man at all.
Alan was silent.
So, Thad said, speaking with the air of a man bringing an important piece of business to a close, that's where matters stand. I can't, I won't, I mustn't. That means he'll come. And when he comes, God knows what will happen.
Thad, Alan said uncomfortably, you need a little perspective on this, that's all. And when you get it, most of it will just blow away, like a milkweed puff, like a bad dream in the morning.
It isn't perspective we need, Liz said.
They looked at her and saw she was crying silently. Not a lot, but the tears were there.
What we need is for someone to turn him off.
6. Alan returned to Castle Rock early the next morning, arriving home shortly before 2 o'clock. He crept into the house as quietly as possible, noticing that Annie had once again neglected to activate the burglar alarm. He didn't like to hassle her about it. Her migraines had become more frequent lately, but he supposed he would have to, sooner or later.
He started upstairs, shoes held in one hand, moving with a smoothness that made him seem almost afloat. His body possessed a deep grace, the exact opposite of Thad Beaumont's clumsiness, which Alan rarely showed. His flesh seemed to know some arcane secret of motion, which his mind found somehow embarrassing. Now, in this silence, there was no need to hide it, and he moved with a shadowy ease that was almost macabre. Halfway up the stairs he paused, and went back down again. He had a small den off the living room, not much more than a broom closet furnished with a desk and some bookshelves, but adequate for his needs. He tried not to bring his work home with him. He did not always succeed in this, but he tried very hard. He closed the door, turned on the light, and looked at the telephone. "You're not really going to do this, are you?" he asked himself. "I mean, it's almost midnight, Rocky Mountain time, and this guy is not just a retired doctor, he's a retired neurosurgeon. You wake him up, and he's apt to chew you a new asshole." Then Alan thought of Liz Beaumont's eyes, her dark, frightened eyes, and decided he was going to do it. Perhaps it would even do some good. A call in the dead of night would establish the fact that this was serious business, and get Dr. Pritchard thinking. Then Alan could call him back at a more reasonable hour. Who knows, he thought without much hope, but with a trace of humor. Maybe he misses getting calls in the middle of the night. Alan took the scrap of paper from the pocket of his uniform blouse and dialed Hugh Pritchard's number in Fort Laramie. He did it standing up, setting himself for a blast of anger from that gravelly voice. He need not have worried. The answering machine cut in after the same fraction of a ring and delivered the same message. He hung up thoughtfully and sat down behind his desk. The gooseneck lamp cast a round circle of light on the desk's surface, and Alan began to make a series of shadow animals in its glow. A rabbit, a dog, a hawk, even a passable kangaroo. His hands possessed that same deep grace which owned the rest of his body when he was alone and at rest. Beneath those eerily flexible fingers, the animals seemed to march in a parade through the tiny spotlight cast by the hooded lamp, one flowing into the next. This little diversion had never failed to fascinate and amuse his children, and had often set his own mind at rest when it was troubled. It didn't work now. Dr. Hugh Pritchard is dead. Stark got him, too. That was impossible, of course. He supposed he could swallow a ghost if someone put a gun to his head, but not some malignant Superman of a ghost who crossed whole continents in a single bound. He could think of several good reasons why someone might turn on his answering machine at night. Not the least of them was to keep from being disturbed by late-calling strangers, such as Sheriff Alan J. Pangborn of Castle Rock, Maine. Yeah, but he's dead. He and his wife, too. What was her name? Helga. I'm probably playing golf. God knows what Helga's up to. But I know what Helga's up to. I know what you're both up to. You're up to your cutthroats in blood, that's what I think. And there's a message written on your living room wall out there in Big Sky Country. It says, "The sparrows are flying again." Alan Pangborn shuddered. It was crazy, but he shuddered anyway. It twisted through him like a wire. He dialed Wyoming directory assistance, got the number for the Fort Laramie Sheriff's Office, and made another call. He was answered by a dispatcher who sounded half asleep. Alan identified himself, told the dispatcher whom he had been trying to contact and where he lived, and then asked if they had Dr. Pritchard and his wife in their vacation file. If the doctor and his wife had gone off on holiday, and it was getting to be that season, they would probably have informed the local law and asked them to keep an eye on the house while it was empty. "Well," dispatch said, "why don't you give me your number? I'll call you back with the information." Alan sighed. This was just more standard operating procedure. More bullshit, not to put too fine a point on it. The guy didn't want to give out the information until he was sure Alan was what he said he was. "No," he said. "I'm calling from home, and it's the middle of the night." "It's not exactly high noon here, Sheriff Pangborn," dispatch answered laconically. Alan sighed. "I'm sure that's true," he said. "And I'm also sure that your wife and kids aren't asleep upstairs. Do this, my friend. Call the Maine State Police Barracks in Oxford, Maine. I'll give you the number. And verify my name. They can give you my law's ID number. I'll call back in 10 minutes or so, and we can exchange passwords." "Shoot it to me," dispatch said. but he didn't sound happy about it. Alan guessed he might have taken the man away from the late show, or maybe this month's penthouse. "What's this about?" dispatch asked after he had read back the Oxford State Police Barracks phone number. "Murder investigation," Alan said, "and it's hot. I'm not calling you for my health, pal." He hung up. He sat behind his desk and made shadow animals and waited for the minute hand to circle the face of the clock 10 times. It seemed very slow. It had only gone around 5 times when the study door opened and Annie came in. She was wearing her pink robe and looked somehow ghostly to him. He felt that shudder wanting to work through him again, as if he had looked into the future and seen something there which was unpleasant. Nasty, even. "How would I feel if it was me he was after?" he wondered suddenly. "Me and Annie and Toby and Todd. How would I feel if I knew who he was, and nobody would believe me?" "Alan, what are you doing sitting down here so late?" He smiled, got up, kissed her easily. "Just waiting for the drugs to wear off," he said. "No, really, is it this Beaumont business?" "Yeah, I've been trying to chase down a doctor who may know something about it. I keep getting his answering machine, so I called the sheriff's office to see if he's in their vacation file. The man on the other end is supposedly checking my bona fides." He looked at Annie with careful concern. "How are you, honey? Headache tonight?" "No," she said, "but I heard you come in." She smiled. "You're the world's quietest man when you want to be, Alan, but you can't do a thing about your car." He hugged her. "Do you want a cup of tea?" she asked. "God, no. A glass of milk, if you want to get one." She left him alone and came back a minute later with the milk. "What's Mr. Beaumont like?" she asked. "I've seen him around town, and his wife comes into the shop once in a while, but I've never spoken to him." The shop was You So and So, owned and operated by a woman named Polly Chalmers. Annie Pangborn had worked there part-time for 4 years. Alan thought about it. "I like him," he said at last. "At first I didn't. I thought he was a cold fish. But I was seeing him under difficult circumstances. He's just distant. Maybe it's because of what he does for a living." "I like both of his books very much," Annie said. He raised his eyebrows. "I didn't know you'd read him." "You never asked, Alan. Then when the story broke about the pen name, I tried one of the other ones." Her nose wrinkled in displeasure. "No good?" "Terrible. Scary. I didn't finish it. I would never have believed the same man wrote both books." "Guess what, babe," Alan thought. "He doesn't believe it either." "You ought to get back to bed," he said, "or you'll wake up with another pounder." She shook her head. "I think the headache monster's gone again, at least for a while." She gave him a look from beneath lowered lashes. "I'll still be awake when you come up. If you're not too long, that is." He cupped one breast through the pink robe and kissed her parted lips. "I'll be up just as fast as I can." She left, and Alan saw that more than 10 minutes had passed. He called Wyoming again and got the same sleepy dispatcher. "Thought you'd forgot me, my friend." "Not at all," Alan said. "Mind giving me your law's number, Sheriff?" 109-44-205-ME. "I guess you're the genuine article, all right. Sorry to put you through this rigmarole so late, Sheriff Pangborn, but I guess you understand." "I do. What can you tell me about Dr. Pritchard?" "Oh, he and his wife are in the vacation file, all right," dispatch said. "They're in Yellowstone Park, camping until the end of the month." "There," Alan thought. "You see? You're down here jumping at shadows in the middle of the night. No cutthroats, no writing on the wall. Just two old folks on a camping trip." But he was not much relieved, he found. Dr. Pritchard was going to be a hard man to get hold of, at least for the next couple of weeks. "If I needed to get a message to the guy, do you think I could do it?" Alan asked. "I'd think so," dispatch said. "You could call Park Services at Yellowstone. They'll know where he is, or they should. It might take a while, but they'd probably get him for you. I've met him a time or two. He seems like a nice enough old fella." "Well, that's good to know," Alan said. "Thanks for your time." "Don't mention it. It's what we're here for." Alan heard the faint rattle of pages and could imagine this faceless man picking up his penthouse again half a continent away. "Good night," he said.
"Good night, Sheriff."
Alan hung up and sat where he was for a moment, looking out the small den window into the darkness. He is out there, somewhere, and he's still coming. Alan wondered again how he would feel if it were his own life, and the lives of Annie and his children at stake. He wondered how he would feel if he knew that, and no one would believe what he knew. "You're taking it home with you again, dear," he heard Annie say in his mind. And it was true. 15 minutes ago, he had been convinced, in his nerve endings, if not in his head, that Hugh and Helga Pritchard were lying dead in a pool of blood. It wasn't true. They were sleeping peacefully under the stars in Yellowstone National Park tonight. So much for intuition. It had a way of just fading out on you. "This is the way Thad's going to feel when we find out what's really going on," he thought. "When we find out that the explanation, as bizarre as it may turn out to be, conforms to all the natural laws." Did he really believe that? Yes, he decided, he really did. In his head, at least. His nerve endings were not so sure. Alan finished his milk, turned off the desk lamp, and went upstairs. Annie was still awake, and she was gloriously naked. She folded him into her arms, and Alan gladly allowed himself to forget everything else. 7. Stark called again 2 days later. Thad Beaumont was in Dave's Market at the time. Dave's was a mom-and-pop store 1.5 miles down the road from the Beaumont house. It was a place to go when running to the supermarket in Brewer was just too much of a pain in the ass. Thad went down that Friday evening to get a 6-pack of Pepsi, some chips, and some dip. One of the troopers watching over the family rode with him. It was June 10th, 6:30 in the evening, plenty of light left in the sky. Summer, that beautiful green bitch, had ridden into Maine again. The cop sat in the car while Thad went in. He got his soda and was inspecting the wild array of dips. You had your basic clam, and if you didn't like that, you had your basic onion. When the telephone rang, he looked up at once, thinking, "Oh, okay." Rosalie, behind the counter, picked it up, said hello, listened, then held the phone out to him, as he had known she would. He was again swallowed by that dreamy feeling of presque vu. "Telephone, Mr. Beaumont." He felt quite calm. His heart had stumbled over a beat, but only one. Now it was jogging along at its usual rate. He was not sweating. And there were no birds. He felt none of the fear and fury he'd felt 3 days earlier. He didn't bother asking Rosalie if it was his wife, wanting him to pick up a dozen eggs or maybe a carton of OJ while he was here. He knew who it was. He stood by the Megabucks computer with its bright green screen announcing there had been no winner last week, and this week's lottery jackpot was $4 million. He took the phone from Rosalie and said, "Hello, George."
"Hello, Thad."
The soft brushstroke of southern accent was still there, but the overlay of country bumpkin was entirely gone. Thad only realized how strongly yet subtly Stark had managed to convey that feeling of, "Hell fire, boys, I ain't too bright, but I sure did get away with it, didn't I, yuck, yuck, yuck," when he heard its complete absence here. But of course, now it's just the boys, Thad thought. Just a couple of white novelists standing around talking. "What do you want?" "You know the answer to that. There's no need for us to play games, is there? It's a little bit late for that."
"Maybe I just want to hear you say it out loud."
That feeling was back, that weird feeling of being sucked out of his body and pulled down the telephone line to some place precisely between the two of them. Rosalie had taken herself down to the far end of the counter, where she was removing packs of cigarettes from a pile of cartons and restocking the long cigarette dispenser. She was ostentatiously not listening to Thad's end of the conversation in a way that was almost funny. There was no one in Ludlow, this end of town anyway, who wasn't aware that Thad was under police guard or police protection or police some damn thing. and he didn't have to hear the rumors to know they had already begun to fly. Those who didn't think he was about to be arrested for drug trafficking no doubt believed it was child abuse or wife beating. Poor old Rosalie was down there trying to be good, and Thad felt absurdly grateful. He also felt as if he were looking at her through the wrong end of a powerful telescope. He was down the telephone line, down the rabbit hole, where there was no white rabbit, but only foxy old George Stark, the man who could not be there but somehow was, all the same. Foxy old George, and down here in Ennsville, all the sparrows were flying again. He fought the feeling, fought hard. "Go on, George," he said, a little surprised by the rough edge of fury in his voice. He was dazed, caught in a powerful undertow of distance and unreality, but God, he sounded so awake and aware. "Say it right out loud, why don't you?"
"If you insist."
"I do."
"It's time to start a new book, a new Stark novel."
"I don't think so."
"Don't say that."
The edge in that voice was like a whiplash loaded with tiny pellets of shot.
"I've been drawing you a picture, Thad. I've been drawing it for you. Don't make me draw it on you."
"You're dead, George. You just don't have the sense to lie down." Rosalie's head turned a little. Thad glimpsed one wide eye before she turned hurriedly back to the cigarette racks again.
"You just watch your mouth."
Real fury in that voice. But was there something more? Was there fear? Pain? Both? Or was he only fooling himself?
"What's wrong, George?" he jeered suddenly. "Are you losing some of your happy thoughts?"
There was a pause then. That had surprised him, thrown him off stride, at least momentarily. Thad was sure of that. But why? What had done it?
"Listen to me, Buddy Roo," Stark said at last. "I'll give you a week to get started. Don't think you can bullshit me because you can't."
Except the last word was really "can't." Yes, George was upset. It might cost Thad a great deal before this was over, but for the time being he felt only savage gladness. He had gotten through. It seemed he was not the only one that felt helpless and dreamily vulnerable during these nightmarishly intimate conversations. He had hurt Stark, and that was utterly fine. Thad said, "That much is true. There's no bullshit between us. Whatever else there may be, there's none of that."
"You got an idea," Stark said. "You had it before that damn kid even thought about blackmailing you. The one about the wedding and the armored car score."
"I threw away my notes. I'm done with you."
"No, those were my notes you threw away. But it doesn't matter. You don't need notes. It'll be a good book."
"You don't understand. George Stark is dead."
"You're the one don't understand," Stark replied.
His voice was soft, deadly, emphatic.
"You got a week. And if you haven't got at least 30 pages of manuscript, I'll be coming for you, Hoss. Only it won't start with you. That'd be too easy. That'd be entirely too easy. I'll take your kids first, and they will die slow. I'll see to it. I know how. They won't know what's happening, only that they're dying in agony. But you'll know, and I'll know, and your wife will know. I'll take her next. Only before I take her, I'll take her. You know what I mean, old hoss. And when they're gone, I'll do you, Thad, and you'll die like no man on earth ever died before."
He stopped. Thad could hear him panting harshly in his ear, like a dog on a hot day.
"You didn't know about the birds," Thad said softly.
"That much is true, isn't it?"
"Thad, you're not making sense. If you don't start pretty soon, a lot of people are going to get hurt. Time is running out."
"Oh, I'm paying attention," Thad said. "What I'm wondering is how you could have written what you did on Clawson's wall and then on Miriam's and not know about it."
"You better stop talking trash and start making sense, my friend," Stark said.
But Thad could sense bewilderment and some rough fear just under the surface of that voice.
"There wasn't anything written on their walls."
"Oh, yes. Yes, there was. And do you know what, George? I think maybe the reason you don't know about that is because
I wrote it. I think part of me was there. Somehow, part of me was there watching you. I think I'm the only one of us who knows about the sparrows, George. I think maybe I wrote it.
You want to think about that. Think about it hard before you start pushing me.
Listen to me, Stark said with gentle force. Hear me real good. First your kids, then your wife, then you. Start another book, Thad. It's the best advice I can give you. Best advice you ever got in your damn life. Start another book. I'm not dead.
A long pause, then softly, very deliberately,
and I don't want to be dead. So you go home and you sharpen your pencils, and if you need any inspiration, think about how your little babies would look with their faces full of glass. They ain't no goddamn birds. Just forget about 'em and start writing.
There was a click.
Fuck you, Thad whispered into the deadline, and slowly hung up the phone.